This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. An investigation into the police response to the Pulse nightclub shooting found none of the clubgoers were hit by friendly fire. More than 400 shots were fired that night, most of them by the shooter. The six-month investigation by the State Attorney's Office found that all of the shots fired by law enforcement, more than 180, were justified. The findings bring some closure for the officers involved and some of the victims' family members, but for others there are still questions. So how much does the latest investigation add to the picture of what happened in Pulse that night? We're taking your calls at 1866 338 5252. That's 1866 338 5252. And we're on Twitter at WMFE Orlando. We're joining us in the studio, 90.7's Emily Lang and Abe Abarai. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks, Matt.
Also joined by Frank Straub. He's the lead author of two after-action reports looking at the Pulse nightclub shooting. He's the National Police Foundation Director of the Centre for Mass Violence Response Studies. Frank, thank you for being here as well.
Thank you very much for having me.
You can join the conversation too if you have questions about this latest report. 1-866-338-5252 is the number. That's 1-866-338-5252. You can also send us a tweet with your questions and comments. We're online at WMFE Orlando. And a note, we are discussing the Pulse nightclub shooting, subject material that may be sensitive or traumatizing to some. So if you have young children or find the subject matter upsetting, you might want to turn your radio down for the next half hour or so. Well, let's start with what the State Attorney for the 9th Judicial Circuit, Aramis Ayala, told reporters at a press conference in Orlando on Wednesday. Here's Ayala summing up the investigation.
All officers have been cleared of any wrongdoing. No casualties were the result of friendly fire, and my review has now been complete.
And here's Chief Assistant State Attorney Deborah Barra, who headed the office investigation.
Each and every engagement, no civilians were struck. And each time the law enforcement officer pulled the trigger, it was reasonable and justifiable.
Emily Lang, I want to start with you. You were at that press conference on Wednesday morning. Just remind us of some of the details from this report.
Right. So in the entire course of the night, more than 400 bullets were shot. 180 of those bullets were shot by the 14 law enforcement officers that were involved in the shooting. The majority of those bullets were shot at a time when they had brought the shooter out of the bathroom with a, like, essentially it was like a smoke bomb that brought him out, and they were shooting through that time. Like we heard Barra said, the state attorney's office concluded that none of those bullets hit any of the patrons in the nightclub. How they kind of laid out their findings for the investigation as Barra walked us through five engagements where police officers interacted with their guns and shot. At one of those engagements, they saw a patron they didn't know was a patron at the time, who they said to show his hands. He didn't comply. So they fired, but he wasn't hit at that time. So he went into the bathroom, and then they realized that he was okay, and then he was able to get out. So at that moment, police officers didn't hit anyone either. Mm-hmm. There is another instance where with the engagements where they weren't sure whether or not the shooter was still with his rifle, and then it was learned that his rifle had jammed and that he only had his handgun at the time.
Mm-hmm. And that was a point that Deborah Barra made. She said partway through that press conference that she believed that lives had been saved by the fact that rifle had been jammed. And correct me if I'm wrong, but the shooter was also doing some kind of Googling while he was in the nightclub. What do we hear about that?
Right, yeah. He was Googling how to unjam his rifle, and he was also Googling how to spell the word allegiance.
Mm-hmm.
So during that time period, Barra said lives were saved due to the fact that he couldn't unjam his rifle and he only had his handgun available to him.
What about the response from police, and what have we heard from families so far, Emily?
So Orange County Sheriff John Mina, he was at the press conference for the report. And whenever he talks about Pulse, he always prefaces how much his heart goes out to the family members and the victims. But I think that really with this report, he was really relieved with his officers. That's what he had said. It's been a long investigation, 6 months into this investigation, and all those officers were cleared. He was the Orlando police chief at the time of the shooting, so this is a little personal for him and the officers that were under his watch. As far as the family members go, It's mixed reactions, right? So Lali Santiago León, she was one of her cousins was killed during the shooting. She told WMFE that she's relieved and offers some type of closure to know that no one was shot by friendly fire, right? Mm-hmm. But then on the other hand, Christine Leinonen, her son Drew Leinonen, was killed at the nightclub. She said it's really hard to believe that police didn't hit a single person other than the shooter. She isn't the only one that finds this surprising. I was at a vigil for Parkland yesterday that was held at the Pulse nightclub. State Representative Carlos Guillermo Smith was there, and he had similar sentiments. I believe we have some tape from him.
It's hard to believe. It's hard to believe with so many weapons, so many bullets that were shot.
That's Carlos Guillermo Smith, a state representative, talking about the report, the investigation from the state attorney's office into police use of force, or police shots fired by the officers responding to the Pulse nightclub shooting more than 2 years ago, and the state attorney's office investigation, which found that none of those bullets fired by police hit any of the nightclub goers. They only hit the shooter himself. Frank Straub with the Police Foundation, I want to bring you into this conversation now. I wonder if you could just talk to us a little bit about police response to the shooting and the five different encounters that were described with the shooter that we heard about on Wednesday. Does the state attorney's narrative match up with what we've heard before?
I think it does. I think that we have to remember that the shooter and the shooter alone is responsible for the deaths that occurred, the injuries, the devastation, and the ongoing trauma to the families, the survivors, the Orlando community, and the nation. Having reviewed now the law enforcement response and the fire response, the FDLE report, it is without doubt that all of the public safety officials that responded to this event did so with the utmost professionalism, dedication to the mission, and bravery. I think we also have to remember that the actions of the officers and deputies inside the club and outside the club, for that matter, with their public safety partners, saved a significant amount of lives. That despite the fact that the assailant repeatedly talked about having improvised explosive devices in the club, some of his claims confirmed at some level by text messages sent from individuals inside the club, the officers continued to do their job. They stayed in the club. They kept the shooter confined to a very small space. During that time, they removed countless individuals who had been severely injured, and their actions saved their lives.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's something that we have to, you know, keep in this context, that the shooter did this. The shooter went into that club and destroyed just way too many lives, right? And one life would have been too many.
Right.
And law enforcement responded admirably to stop the devastation.
I don't think anybody sort of listening would doubt that there's one person and one person alone who's responsible for the carnage, but there is no doubt some skepticism amongst listeners, amongst some family members, that of all those bullets fired, you know, more than half of them, of course, coming from the shooter's guns, but the police did fire quite a few rounds in the course of that three-hour standoff. We have a tweet from a listener here who writes, Kokomo Kid writes, "Give us a break. There's no way that none of the police bullets hit patrons. Why didn't the report just say that?" Abe Abariah, if I could bring you into this conversation. We heard quite a bit during the state attorney's office report on their investigation about how they looked at trajectories. They looked at the path of those bullets. They analyzed some of the body cam footage. They listened to 911 calls. They compiled all of this data and decided that that was what made them pretty sure pretty confident that none of those bullets fired by police hit patrons. But can you kind of understand or can you sort of block out for us a little bit, why people might be saying, well, look, this kind of doesn't add up, or how can you say for absolute certainty that that none of those bullets would have hit any of those patrons in that club?
Well, and there's a couple different parts of that question. So sort of the first thing to deal with that is that, the state attorney's office has not produced the FBI report. So, they did produce the FDLE report that came from state investigators over, looking at why the 14 different officers used deadly force that mm-hmm. night. But what was not produced was the FBI ballistics report during that. So we're still waiting on that ballistic report to come out. So in a sense, if you're kind of taking the grade school teacher approach to it, I think there's until you sort of see their work, in a sense, there's going to be some skepticism with that, you're taking the state attorney's office at their word. And you have to keep in mind that the state attorney's office is looking at a very narrow scope. They're looking mm-hmm. at, whether the officers involved who opened fire were justified in that. And they did come out and say that none of the civilians were hit. Some of the skepticism with that I've heard from, not just the, family members, you also have, I've heard from a number of experts who deal with autopsy reports, who deal with this stuff, saying essentially that it's difficult to come to such a concrete conclusion because, when you're dealing with these gunshot wounds, he was using, high-powered rifle. Police were also using rifles. A lot of the gunshot wounds are not going – a lot of the victims who passed away are not going to have the actual bullets inside of them. So when they're able to go through and look at it, they may have been able to say, of the bullets recovered that we definitively know were inside of one of the victims, that these bullets did not come from police. But, there is still questions about, if a bullet went through victim A and then landed in a wall and left no, that it's difficult to make such a broad and definitive conclusion that no one was hit.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, it's in a sense, it's speculation because we don't know. But I think that's where the skepticism comes from, is that it is such a definitive conclusion that none of the civilians were hit during the course of that. So
right. And I just want to come back to you for a moment, if I could, Frank Straub. I mean, keep in mind, this was a very complicated crime scene, 49 deceased, more than 50 injured. Have you talked to some of the officers who fired their weapons? Because, we heard during the state attorney's office report that one of the encounters, they described how officers thought they saw the shooter coming out of the bathroom. They issued instructions to show, to show me your hands, and the person in the bathroom, coming out of the bathroom, didn't comply, so they fired shots. And then the state attorney's office report said, well, we know that that person was not hurt or injured by those shots, because then later they were able to come out of the bathroom and be rescued from the club. But it paints a little bit of a picture of the chaos in the nightclub and the kind of split-second decisions that officers were having to make in that situation. Give us a sense of what it's like for officers in that situation. They're dealing with this chaotic scene and they're trying to make those decisions. How much pressure are they under?
Well, I think they were under tremendous pressure. And we did. We spoke to a number of the officers, some of whom had been deployed overseas to places like Iraq and Afghanistan, and where they had seen some horrific injuries and had been involved in some horrific firefights in a war zone. And many of those officers who had been in that situation described the devastation and the injuries in the club as being as bad, if not worse, in some cases, than their combat experiences. So I think, yes, there is tremendous amount of chaos, of audio-visual stimulation going on. But I think let's go back a little bit, right? So, the first time an officer fires his weapon is Detective Gula, who sees the two individuals come out of the door, fall on the ground. He sees part of the shooter and tries to engage the shooter, right? And so those rounds appear to have been accounted for in and around that door.
And bear in mind, this is the you know, plainclothes officer who was working security that night, and so he had a handgun. So the different sort of velocities involved.
Exactly right. The next time the Detective Gruler fires his weapon is at a standing individual in the club who he sees shooting into individuals lying on the floor. And that's the only person standing, right? So again, with his sidearm, he fires at the shooter. So there's the first kind of set of rounds, you know, being fired by an officer, certainly justifying, you know, his actions. He's trying to prevent injury and more injury by the shooter. He, in essence, his action stops the shooter, at least for a short period of time. The hallway incident, having been in the club, under the conditions, at least the darkness and low light conditions, the officers are positioned in the area of the bar at the end of the hall. They see this individual. They give multiple commands. The individual fails to comply, and they engage the individual. I think it's very reasonable that if that individual, as stated by the FDLE, said that he was the person in the hallway that was shot at, and he wasn't injured, and he eventually survives, I think he would know that he was shot at,
right?
And that he wasn't injured, and he did survive. So, you know, we've now accounted for another grouping of shots. The fact that there's this volley of shots at the point where the rescue now is going on, and they've put the holes in the wall, they've deployed two flashbangs, and the shooter emerges and doesn't just emerge and say, you know, hi, or I give up. He emerges firing at the officers who are standing in and around this hole that's been created. And in fact, hits a police officer, luckily.
Right. Hits him in the helmet.
In the helmet, right? Had the officer not had that helmet on, he most probably would have been deceased. So you have somebody who everybody knows has killed a number of people. They've heard gunshots. They've now thrown these devices with the expectation that they're going to make entry, and instead the shooter pops out and immediately engages the officers and shoots one. They then engage the shooter with, I think, the obligation, and a very clear obligation, to neutralize the threat to themselves of somebody who has clearly demonstrated that he is incredibly dangerous and incredibly violent.
Right.
And one, again, looking at that hallway now from the outside in, there wouldn't have been people from inside the club in that hallway. You know, there was the shooter,
right,
and that was the person engaged. So I think we, again, have to be careful, right? And this is a horrific situation, and we're seeing way too many of these horrific situations. But I think let's keep the focus where it belongs, on an incredibly disturbed individual who had pledged his allegiance during the event to a terrorist organization.
Right. Once he'd figure out how to spell allegiance, sure.
Right. Right. But look at what he did, and look at what he caused. And then I think let's be proud of the men and women who risked their lives for several hours and kept their lives in jeopardy to rescue individuals from inside the club and to neutralize this individual who in many ways was evil incarnate.
I just want to bring in a question from a listener here. And Emily, just remind us if we heard much detail about this during the press conference, because as the state attorney, Aramis Ayala, mentioned, it was a kind of a narrowly focused investigation. But we have a question here. Did the investigation discuss the police use of an explosive breach to gain entry to the Pulse nightclub during the 2016 massacre? Were any victims wounded or killed during that breach? What do we hear about the way they gained entry into the club?
Yeah, so Barra talked about that. They kind of blew a hole into the wall of the nightclub and were able to enter mm-hmm. that way. And no, Barra didn't mention that at that time. No club goers were hurt because of how they decided to enter the nightclub. Mm-hmm. And this is just kind of adding to what we're talking about. I think that's compounding the criticism and skepticism of police officers involved in the shooting, right? I think Mina gained some criticism earlier on in this investigation due to the 3-hour time delay that right. we saw in the investigation. But this report, that wasn't really the scope of what it was. But I think that comes with family reactions. They have, you know, knowing that 3-hour time delay, because they treated it like a hostage situation, mm-hmm. that's still compounded with, you know,
right, because at a
criticism
certain,
that we're seeing now.
Because at a certain point, as we've heard, the shooter was saying that he had explosives. They had to check out the scene and make sure there weren't explosives around. Just going back to you, Abe, for a moment, if I could, the narrowness of the focus, you've been doing a lot of work in the last 12 months, more than that, in fact, looking into PTSD, and also some of your reporting last year about the kind of notion of being able to send in a rescue task force, a group of EMTs who would have body armor and be under police escort and be able to get to those victims sooner to try and triage and treat them. We did actually hear from the state attorney that you know, whether or not some more people could have been saved if they'd been gotten to sooner, that wasn't part of what they were investigating. Were you expecting more from this investigation? Were you expecting the scope to be a little broader than it ended up being?
Well, I mean, I think when you're talking about what the state attorney was investigating, I think I wasn't too shocked that the scope of her investigation was, you know, was the use of deadly force, you know, necessary and, you know, justifiable. So I think that wasn't surprising. You know, I think what we were all expecting, though, was sort of to be able to get a hold of this FBI report that details, you know, a lot of the questions that we still have outstanding. You know, we still do not know for certain which victims were found where inside the club. So we there are still basic questions that we still have not been able to get to, you know, which does kind of go back to this idea of a rescue task force and, you know, who was in the bathroom with the shooter, who would have been, you know, essentially, you know, out of reach for a rescue task force versus who was maybe on the dance floor that maybe could have benefited from getting, you know, medical help sooner. And that was one of the things that we did find last year. There was the peer-reviewed study that looked at, you know, and found that there were 16 victims that their conclusion was, had they been able to get, you know, basic medical care and then brought to a trauma center faster, that they may have been able to survive their wounds. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as far as those questions about, you know, and one of the, you know, questions that we've seen is sort of this idea of, well, the rifle jammed, you know, would that have changed it had they known? And I think that had they known that his rifle was jammed, I don't know that that would have changed the police response. You know, they were following the Orlando Police Department's barricaded gunman policy that's been in place. But it may have, you know, had there been some way, you know, I guess magically for them to know definitively that his rifle was jammed.
Right.
You know, one of the questions that or one of the fears that were brought up during that shooting was that he did have a long gun and that his bullets could theoretically have penetrated the wall and
right.
gotten to, you know, the dance floor where the bulk of these victims were. And that was a concern for the paramedic, you know, bringing in a team of paramedics and EMTs. So, you know, I think there are still a lot of questions that need to be answered. And it's, you know, 2.5 years later, and we're still kind of waiting to get some of those final reports.
And still asking questions. Abe Abariah with 90.7, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely.
Also joined by 90.7's Emily Lang, thank you as well.
Thanks, Matt.
And Frank Straub, he is the National Police Foundation Director of the Center for Mass Violence Response Studies. Frank, thank you as well.
Thank you, sir.
Up next, how Venezuelans in Orlando are working to help the opposition to President Nicolas Maduro. Intersection is back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. As the opposition in Venezuela continues to put pressure on President Nicolas Maduro to step down, members of Orlando's Venezuelan community are also working to garner support for the opposition movement outside the country. While Oscar Madera with the Primero Justicia Party applied for political asylum in the U.S. after coming to Florida in 2015. Madera tells WMFE that she believes Maduro's days in power are numbered. Well, Oscar Madera, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for this time to listen what is the situation in our country that is really important than other communities wants to know what is the real situation in Venezuela right now.
So the crisis in Venezuela has been going on for nearly 5 years since the start of the economic recession and the soaring inflation rates after President Nicolas Maduro came to power. You left some time ago. At what point did you decide you couldn't stay in Venezuela anymore?
Okay, so as me, a lot of people knew on 2014, there was a crisis where the students, a lot of protests, were persecuted by the government, including like force, the armed force, the security who worked for the government, and those armed groups, they get guns, and they just go through you if you think different and you protest. That is our liberty of expression. Mm-hmm. So from that time, on the protest of 2014, more than 20 people were killed because they thought different.
So you decided sometime in 2014 that you couldn't stay in Venezuela.
That's right, yes. For that reason, I came here to the United States. A lot of people start going out of Venezuela since 2014.
Mm-hmm. Was it hard to make that transition to decide to leave your country behind and move somewhere different?
Yes, 100%. When you belong to a country and you want to represent your country, living for freedom and fighting for freedom, it's hard for you to leave your country. And it's hard for me and for all the Venezuelans being outside Venezuela right now because we have part of us inside Venezuela.
So the organization that you're part of, Primero Justicia, is a centrist political party of Venezuela, obviously opposes the sitting president, Nicolas Maduro, who in the U.S. and the majority of other European countries consider illegitimate at this point. What is the goal of this organization for the diaspora in Orlando?
Basically, as Primero Justicia and other different political parties, what we want is to be one only organization. We want a union. We want to fight for the freedom. And in Orlando specifically, we want to be the voice for those who are in Venezuela and they can't say what is the real crisis of the humanitarian situation right now.
Are you also trying to provide some practical help for people back in Venezuela or other people who might have recently moved to Florida?
Yes, we have been doing different kind of meetings where we explain them where to go if they need any help, who are the persons who can give them some different advisement. We also provide them different churches where they can go if they don't have anything to eat. Mm-hmm. I want to say this. It's really important that a lot of Venezuelans who arrive to United States, they don't come here just because they want to be on vacation. They are coming here because there are humanitarian crises.
American politicians are divided on whether or not the United States should get involved and intervene in Venezuela. You have National Security Advisor John Bolton announcing oil sanctions last month. There's currently humanitarian aid sitting on the border of Colombia and Venezuela waiting to be released and allowed in. What kind of intervention, if any, would you like to see from the United States?
As Venezuelan, I have to say that I don't want any kind of intervention because it means a lot of blood. Mm. It means a lot of, you know, people dying. But to be honest with you, United States, what wants right now is humanitarian help.
you would like to just see some humanitarian aid from the US.
That's right, yes. Mm-hmm. As long as I'm doing the interview right now with you, there is a lot of people dying right now. So how long Venezuelan has to wait to get this help? It's not only United States. It has been other different countries, Canada, United Kingdom. I heard that Brazil, Colombia, and a lot of countries, more than 50 countries, are supporting this help. So it's more about human help. Mm-hmm. It's not about military intervention.
Waleska Madara, she is part of Primero Justicia. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for your time and for listening to the crisis that we are having right now.
Still to come on Intersection, new music from Hannah Harbour. We're back in a minute. This is Intersection, I'm Matthew Petty. Hannah Harbour and the Lionhearts have a debut album out, and they're celebrating its release with a performance in Orlando this weekend. And here's the title track from the album, Long Time Coming.
Side of the sun.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. Hannah Harbour with the title track from her new album, Long Time Coming. Hannah Harbour, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So your debut album is Long Time Coming. What was the process like of making that album?
It was really wonderful. We decided we wanted to... My band is called Hannah Harbour and the Lionhearts, and we had been talking about making a record for a long time, and hence Long Time Coming, I guess. But we started thinking about the process, I would say, about a year ago, with what songs we would want to put on it, and started raising a little bit of money ourselves, and then did a Kickstarter campaign, which helped us kind of get across the mark financially. Mm-hmm. And we recorded all of the instrumentation here in Central Florida at a studio in Castleberry called Pioneer Sound. And then went to Nashville to do the vocals and all the mixing and mastering.
So the two strands of the album, you had to sort of weave them together afterwards.
We did.
Was that a strange experience?
I think, you know, not recording the whole thing live, you know, you learn how to have multiple takes and multiple tracks. And mm-hmm. the studio can be a really unforgiving environment, but it can also be one that really helps you learn what a song really calls for and what your voice can do or what your instruments can do. And so we felt really proud of what we accomplished with the instrumentation, and have a great friend in Nashville who we knew we wanted to work with to do the vocals. And so I think going into it, knowing that that was the plan, kind of helped that mm-hmm. not feel separated.
And I was looking on your band's Facebook page. You mm-hmm. played at the Graham Parsons Dairy Down not too long ago. Yeah. Tell me about that.
That is such a wonderful venue. You know, the history of the place with Graham, and, you know, he painted the walls. And there's just this, you can feel there's a tangible presence of just goodness in that room. And it's run by a wonderful organization in Winter Haven. And they are really trying to get songwriters who not only love Graham, but just are really interested in honing their craft. And the room is quiet and wonderful, full of people who love music. And so I've been honored to be there. It's the second time that I was there. And we actually have our first headlining show there March 30th.
Mm-hmm. So do you feel like you're sort of fitting into a tradition of music in Florida, and is this part of it?
It's an honor to say yes, but yeah, I do think that that's, you know, we're hoping to honor those that came before us and also tap into whatever feels like an honest sound to be made right now.
Is there any instrument you wouldn't consider putting in your album? Like, do you kind of feel like you work within a narrow range of instrumentation, or there's some sounds that you're thinking that might be an interesting sound to incorporate into the next album or next song?
Yeah, I don't know if that, I can think of one off the top of my head that I would say absolutely no to, but there are things that ended up on this album, actually the Long Time Coming record, that I did not go into it thinking, oh, we're going to put this on there, including the producer, Thomas Wynn. He did some very interesting vocal sounds that ended up sounding more like a pad or a synth, but it's actually his voice in some of the tracks, and so we let ourselves branch out a little bit.
Okay, correct me if I'm wrong, but yeah. Thomas Wynn is also your husband?
He is, okay. Yes, he is.
The producer.
Yes, but he also produced it, and it's funny to have your creative life combined with your personal life in that way. And so, you know, we try not to let too much of that, like the connection that we have personally, be what supersedes, you know, a creative endeavor. Of mm-hmm. course it plays into it. But there were days in the studio where I had to, you know, take off my wife hat and just be like, okay, producer and, you know, artist in this role, and mm-hmm. and try to manage that appropriately. He plays drums
songs?
On some of the songs. On one song on the record, he's playing drums, and he plays drums with us live sometimes. But the rest of the album is made with a drummer, Ryan Smith, who's phenomenal. Mm-hmm. And Thomas plays guitar and does a lot of the backing vocals on it as well. And whenever I can have him live, he's a part of the band, that's for sure.
Do you ever feel like you just have to get away from music altogether? Like, do your holidays involve leaving your guitar behind, or do you have to bring it with you?
They used to. I think I compartmentalized music for a long time because it wasn't what I was pursuing full time, and I felt like it was not necessarily a worthy distraction. Thankfully, I've healed from a lot of that the older I've gotten. And so, yeah, they come with us for vacations. But I think, honestly, I don't know if we take real ones. We tend to add tour stops into places that we want to visit and call that a vacation.
Right.
So, you know, yeah, they're with us at all times.
Mm-hmm. Do you enjoy touring?
I do. I haven't done it much with this band, but Thomas's band, Thomas Wynn and the Believers, I've traveled pretty extensively with them. We did a European tour last year, and I really enjoy that pace. I think there's a freedom of being on the road that also, for me, it's interesting. I'm much more meticulous in my schedule and my my suitcase is gorgeously packed. And, you know, there's things about my life that I feel so able to be regimented when I'm moving like that.
So you're a good packer.
I'm a really good packer.
Because there's a lot of stuff you got to keep tabs on when you're away. Right?
Yeah, and we have a little guy. He's 3. And so packing for him, too, is quite an experience.
Is he musical?
He has a little drum set. He's into it. He definitely has favorite songs of ours, and we kind of use him as a litmus test. You know, if he gets really into one, it's like, okay, well, maybe that one, maybe there's something in there that we tapped into. But neither one of us really want to force it on him. But by nature of his lifestyle, he's certainly around it more often than most kids.
What's the appetite for Americana and American roots music in Europe?
It's like rabid. It's beautiful to watch because I went over with Thomas. I wasn't playing, so I got to be a spectator. And to see how little people left the room or when they were in the room started talking. I mean, it was quiet and people paid attention. And these were like full-blown rock and roll shows. It wasn't just like a listening room environment. And so that was really appreciated. And I think there's a great, you know, kind of bond that's being made. Even the Americana Music Association now has a UK partnership. And so I think there's a really, really great friendship that's brewing between American roots music, or that has been there forever. And we're just, you know, now a new generation of it.
I guess there's a lot of porousness between what American artists have done in the past and are doing now and what British artists have done, right? I mean, there are so many great English bands that kind of plunder from the, you know, the pantheon of American music to make their sound. So I imagine that sort of goes both ways.
Absolutely. And, you know, if we're such a young country, to be in other places where just their history is longer, their storyline goes a little deeper than the one that we might have. And so the honoring of their roots music is really beautiful. And that, I think, because they honor theirs so well, they recognize the value in what we're trying to call our roots music.
I wanted to ask you, too, about the sign, the symbol you have on the T-shirt. It's an old Florida motel sign that used to be up on 13th Street, Southwest 13th Street in Gainesville. It's now been taken down, but you've kind of immortalized this in some of your band merchandise.
Yes.
Tell me about why you wanted to put that on your T-shirt.
Yeah, well, I just have a love for old neon or old motel signs in general. I think, you know, growing up in a small town in Florida and you see so many of them driving old back roads or old highways. And I had driven past that Florida motel sign so many times going to school at the University of Florida. And when I knew I wanted to make something that was sort of Florida honoring, but not necessarily what you might envision for some of the logo art, that was what came to mind. And a local artist by the name of Shannon Staunton hand drew that for me. And now the sign has been taken down. So I do feel grateful that we've sort of let it live on in our logo.
Ballet Who in the Orlando Weekly called you one of the sharpest, most cogent roots voices in the city. Tell me about your sound. Like, how have you kind of crafted it? Are there certain artists you look to as your what you want to sound like, or what you're kind of emulating a little bit?
Yeah, I've learned about my voice, and I am so grateful for it. That you know, when you start listening to different artists, and you want to make music or you want to write songs, I think it's just natural to try to do the thing that these other great singers do. And then you might get dejected when you realize that your voice doesn't do that. And so I had some of that when I was younger and feeling like, well, maybe I'm just not that great a singer and maybe I'll just try to write songs. And then I realized, you know, the people who I really look up to, artists like Patti Griffin, she's kind of my end all be all. I would not be able to sit still or be normal in a room with her. Anyway, you know, it's not that she does have a really beautiful, powerful voice, but it's not the stereotypical powerhouse singer that you might think of. And the way that she was able to use what she naturally has to just convey emotion and to write these really powerful, honest songs. She was someone I, and still do, greatly look up to. As far as making a sound, you know, growing up in a small town there, and my parents are both big music fans, our vacations a lot of times would be traveling to festivals. And so on that circuit, you end up seeing a lot more of the kind of roots music scene. Mm-hmm. And so it was bands, you know, back then, like the Avett Brothers and the Ducks. And I saw Nickel Creek before they were, you know, kind of wildly famous. And I just really latched onto this idea that you can sound however you want to sound and chase the muse however you'd like to. But as long as it feels honest to you. And mm-hmm. so I don't know that I necessarily said I want to set out to make an Americana record, but I without a doubt write songs that are in that vein and have a voice that lends itself that way.
So where did you grow up?
High Springs, so just north of Gainesville. And my parents, we moved out kind of past the city limits when I was in the fifth grade. And so a lot of time on the river, a lot of time riding horses.
And music was a big part of your life
as
a kid?
Yeah, my dad's a bass player, and so he played in the church, and that was kind of my original introduction, is kind of like, you know, youth choir, and then we did musical theater when we were kids. And my parents were just always very accepting and open to the idea of us pursuing creative endeavors, and so I, you know, went to college, got a degree that I no longer use and wish that I would have studied music. But like I said, at the time, I just had this headspace of this is a fun thing. This is not a thing that can be, you know, that can manifest itself to be lucrative.
So you've got a show coming up this weekend. What can the audience expect?
It's actually the celebration of the album release. We released Long Time Coming January 9th. And we're so excited. The Swamp Sisters are opening the show for us, along with a great singer-songwriter from New Orleans who just moved here. Her name's Christina Morales. It'll be at Will's Pub at 8 o'clock.
Well, Hannah Harbour, thank you so much for coming in and playing
for
us.
Thank you for having me.
And to take us out, Hannah Harbour with another track from Hannah Harbour and the Lionhearts' new album. It's called Oh Papa. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Ashley Garrett. Production assistance for today's show from Abe Abariah, Emily Lang, and Juan Gualda. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we're on the NPR One app. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.